welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 8th of November 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. We're back once again. We had a two-week break, and we are assembled here once again to discuss the week's news with my co-host here today, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing? Did you have a nice week off?
I did, actually, yes. It's last week was a week during which I've been able to attend to lots of personal things that I needed to attend to. So it's been good that I've been able to do that.
Well, I had a great weekend at the PA conference, and I'm sure listeners have already availed themselves of the speeches and heard of all the excitement that went on there. And that's mainly what we were sort of talking about last week at Radio Albion and also on Patriotic Weekly Review. And we sort of missed out on the news, really, but there has been quite a few news articles that are of interest to us. And the first one concerns something that we've discussed before in the past. Gary Lineker. I'm not really much of a fan of Gary Lineker, and I don't really watch much television, but I do know that he is extremely highly paid by the BBC, and he's very outspoken on these woke ideas that he likes to promote. And you were telling me, Max, that he's just been in the news recently for something.
Well, yeah, Gary Lineker's been in the news again with regard to refugees, because he made some pronouncement. I can't quite think what he said. This was around about perhaps the best part of a year ago, where he was saying that we ought to take refugees in, and quite a number of people, as I recall, in the news media basically accused him of virtue signalling, and that basically said that if he felt that that's what ought to be done, then because he's a very wealthy man, he ought to think about putting up a refugee in his own home, and he appears to have done that, basically, he sort of made comments today saying, how can anyone have a total lack of empathy for people of the most people in the most dire circumstances? It wasn't just a one-off like the public perception was. It's genuine. I got a lot out of it. This is him providing a home for a refugee. And it was just a wonderful experience. And the news reports in today's news say that he is finalising paperwork with a refugee charity at the moment and will soon take in another person from Balochistan. And Balochistan isn't a well-known part of the world, so I decided to look that up. And it's actually part of Iran, part of Pakistan, and a small part of on the southern fringe of Afghanistan. And Lineker is reported as saying in the news today that I will never be able to comprehend being attacked for wanting to help people who are being bombed, who are risking their lives, jumping on dinghies because they're so desperate. And he has welcomed, last year he welcomed a law student called Rashid into his Surrey home. Through the refugee, through the charity Refugees at Home. This was in August last year, and perhaps it might be August this year, I'm not quite sure. But after that, he was, as I say, he was criticised for virtue signalling, and he said that the youngster was from the reports state that the youngster was from the mountainous Balochistan region that straddles Pakistan and Iran, and lived with the former England Leicester Star for 20 days while studying a law course. And of course, when we spoke about it last time, I seem to remember that we were saying that if Gary Lineker did take in a refugee, it wouldn't just be a random refugee that sort of has just jumped off a boat on the south beach of on the south coast of England. It would be a refugee that would be very carefully selected so that he would fit in with Gary Lineker as much as possible. And we are able to find out from the report today that the refugee that was taken in was a law student, so he wasn't a typical refugee. And instead of being put up for a substantial length of time, Gary Lineker only put him up for 20 days, apparently, according to the news reports today.
So just under 3 weeks then, basically.
And just under 3 weeks.
We know what these refugees are normally like. They're not really fleeing war because it's not women and children. I was reading a news report today, I think it was in Breitbart, and it was suggesting that the reason why these alleged refugees are so highly featured in gang rapes and grooming gangs is because there weren't any women that actually came over with them in the boats, because they're 90% male, and there's none of their own women that actually came over with them. So they're sort of stuck without any women. They're not having much luck at dating with white women over here. So they ended up forcing themselves upon them. And this was a theory that was actually put forward in Breitbart. So, I mean, we can just see with our own eyes that they're all young men of fighting age. And we've seen some of them just talking about the money that they're looking forward to get. I mean, this is what why they're risking coming over in a boat to England. If they want sanctuary from war, all they have to do is go to Turkey. That's much closer to them. Or they could go to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia's got a huge, great tent city there that they use for the Hajj. That could be used for refugees.
Or if they live in Balochistan, they've just got to walk across the Pakistani border into Pakistan, where there isn't a war going on, or they could walk across the border into Iran where there isn't a war going on. And so, you know, Balochistan isn't currently being bombed. I can appreciate that there might be some parts of Balochistan in the very the southern part of Afghanistan that might have seen some bombing in the past, but Balochistan as a whole isn't being bombed. And all the immigrants that came to the UK, or I'd say all of them, the vast majority of them, come via France or Belgium, and France and Belgium aren't being bombed either. And they are the countries, or perhaps even countries that the migrants reach earlier than France and Belgium, are the countries where those migrants should be claiming asylum, if indeed they are asylum seekers. If they're not asylum seekers, if they're cherry picking, which country in Europe they want to settle in order to find the one that's going to be the most accommodating for them, then that's not being an asylum seeker, that's being an economic migrant. And so the things stated by Gary Lineker in order to justify him and to dispel the feeling, the fairly widespread feeling amongst many commentators that he was virtue signalling, those things just don't hold up.
Well, I also hear there's been a bit of a mutiny amongst Priti Patel's border force. They're refusing to actually turn any of these boats back. You remember that was the plan we were discussing a few weeks back. They were going to go out there on their jet skis and they were going to turn the dinghies around and send them back to France. Well, apparently they said, no, we're not doing that. So that's another one of these plans that's hit the dust. I mean, the only solution to this is to set up a camp that is actually watched by the British, that's under British law in a part of Africa, and say to these people, look, you can go there and you can be safe from war, and we'll provide you food, we'll provide you healthcare, and that will keep them safe, and it will also keep us safe from them breaking into the country. And if they know that if they do break into the country, they will just be taken to this camp where they will be safe, which will be in Africa, they will stop coming. I mean, that solved the problem for Australia. It's so simple. That's all they have to do. But they won't do it. They'll keep coming up with these harebrained ideas of turning the boats around, and the border force just won't do that, and the French won't accept that either. They've said that that's illegal. Priti Patel says it is legal, but the border force are just refusing to do it. I mean, we know that the public support is on our side. You know, whenever they do these polls, people say, well, look, we don't want illegal immigrants here. We don't want foreign criminals here either. They should be repatriated. I think 60% of France recently said that foreign criminals should be repatriated. And yet our European governments refuse to do anything about this, apart from the ones in the East. Poland and Hungary, they're brilliant. They keep producing these videos showing them sending back the illegal immigrants and protecting the border from them and saying what a good job they're doing. And you can compare that to what we're doing here in Britain, and there's just waves of them that keep washing up on the beaches, basically. And that's just the ones that we know about. What about the ones that just disappear into the darkness that we're not able to keep track of?
And the people that object to migrants coming to the UK in the way that they are, illegally in many cases, but as uncontrolled mass immigration. The people who object to that sort of thing are objecting to the transformation of their country by such large numbers of immigrants coming to Britain, and putting a single immigrant that's been cherry-picked and carefully selected up for just 20 days doesn't in any way compare to a little old lady who finds herself the last white woman in the street that she's lived in all her life, surrounded by immigrants that she's got very little in common with.
That's just an insult, isn't it? It's an insult to the intelligence of the public to think that Gary Lineker has done anything remotely similar to what the indigenous British people have to put up with when there's a hotel full of fake asylum seekers just up the road from them. I mean, this is what they're doing. They're putting them up in the hotels. I did also read that the Afghans weren't happy with the hotel that they were put in, and they were saying we would rather be sent back home. The food's not good enough for us. Of course, we had fake refugees last year in Scotland that said the food's not good enough for us, and they went on a stabbing rampage. And I'm sure this isn't the last we're going to hear of the fake refugees or Gary Lineker, unfortunately. But we also have a university in the news once again. Oxford University, famous for trying to get rid of the Cecil Rhodes statue, one of their benefactors. Here they're trying to get rid of another of their benefactors, Max. What's been going on over there at Oxford University?
Well, this is where you remember that there was a bit of a fuss made a while back over Cecil Rhodes and the fact that he had donated large amounts of money to various colleges in Oxford, primarily, I think, Ariel College. And there's a statue of him high up on the wall in Ariel College. And there were lots of students that were campaigning to bring about his the downfall of his statue. They wanted to pull his statue down as part of this sort of Black Lives Movement campaign. But now what's happened is that it transpires that the a trust set up by Max Mosley, who is the son of Sir Oswald Mosley, and a trust that's been set up in his son's name, Alexander Mosley, has donated just over £12 million now to two colleges that compose parts of Oxford University. And some of the money is going to be used to set up an Alexander Mosley Professor of Biophysics Fund. The other money is going to be used to create student accommodation, which I thought, I would have thought that would have been something that students would have felt was beneficial towards them. But the fact that I don't know whether either of these two, whether the student accommodation or whether the a part of any of the university is going to be named after Alexander Mosley. But we've had a Professor Lawrence Goldman of Oxford, who has said that the universities he's accused them of moral failure. And there's been criticism by Lord Mann, who is a very fervent campaigner on Jewish rights, and also the campaign against anti-Semitism have piped up again, saying that it's wrong that this money should have been accepted, that before the money was accepted, there should have been a public apology for the views that Sir Oswald Mosley held, despite the fact that this money is being donated by a trust set up for the benefit of or in honour of his grandson. This isn't a trust that's honouring Sir Oswald Mosley. And the campaign against anti-Semitism has suggested that the money should only be accepted if some of the money that's donated is used to combat anti-Semitism. And so it's kind of hypocrisy, really, on the part of all these people. And generally speaking, a fuss made over what is a donation that was made with genuine goodwill in the hope of improving the lot of students in Cambridge, and also in providing additional funding to develop the the work that Oxford University does in the field of biophysics.
Yeah, it's ridiculous that they're going after his grandson. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just shameful behaviour, really. Okay, you don't like Oswald Mosley's views. What does that have to do with his grandson? I mean, his grandson probably hardly even knew Oswald Mosley. Has his grandson said that he supports fascism or anything like that? No, he hasn't. It's just ridiculous that they're going after him. And they've actually succeeded in putting a new plaque on Cecil Rhodes' statue, which implies that he oppressed the African peoples and he made his money by oppressing them. I mean, he employed them, basically. I don't really see why it's employment when it's white people, but it's oppression when it's black people that are actually being paid to dig up the diamonds and what have you. And as we learned in our Greatest Britain series, if it wasn't for colonialism, then slavery would still be going on in Africa. That was the whole point of colonialism, was to link the settlements up with roadways and transport so that they could start making their own products and transport them to the ports and trade with the rest of the world with products instead of human beings. That was the whole point of colonialism. And we did a series on Cecil Rhodes, didn't we, in our Greatest Britons, looking at him. He was a very good man, obviously, and David Livingstone, who came up with this idea. And I was looking at the article to do with this, and it mentions a few other things that Oxford have been up to. In March, Oxford was considering changes to the music curriculum, including alternative titles for courses, after certain staff raised concerns about the complicity in white supremacy in the teaching of the subject. Professors were set to reform their music courses to move beyond the classic repertoire, which includes the likes of Beethoven and Mozart, in the wake of the BLM movement. University staff argued that the current curriculum focuses on white European music from the slave period, according to The Telegraph. So they're going to change the music. We can't have any music from before 1900, I guess, because there was also slavery in the world at that time. I mean, what classical musicians are they going to study that were actually black? I mean, we have some black classical musicians now, of course, in the last 70 years or so, but we don't have any from 200 years ago or from 300 years ago, so we must just write off that part of history. And it continues, documents seen by the publication indicate proposed reforms to target undergraduate courses. It claimed that teaching musical notation had not shaken off its connection to the colonial past and would be a slap in the face to some students, so that they're not even going to teach them musical notation, I guess, because the notation of music was invented about 200 or 300 years ago, so we can't have that. It finishes up by saying it added that musical skills should no longer be compulsory because the current repertoire's focus on white European music causes students of colour great distress. So they no longer even need to be able to play any musical instruments, because if they're expected to be able to play musical instruments, it causes students of colour great distress because they haven't actually learned to play them. I mean, it's just incredible, isn't it? It's like reading satire, isn't it?
It is. They've picked on two Germanic composers to name as two that they whose music will no longer be taught or whatever, but they didn't think about the Spanish musicians, because I would imagine there probably would have been lots of Spanish musicians that produced music during the period of the that there was the North Atlantic slave trade. But what about all the music from North Africa, where the Barbary pirates lived, who captured and sort of pillaged the coastal towns of Europe, taking white slaves and selling them in the Middle East? You know, should we now ban music from North Africa as well? And what about the music from Africa, where certain tribes in Africa who presumably had some form of music were the ones who were actually enslaving their sort of rival tribes and selling them to the European traders? Shouldn't we ban their music as well? As far as banning things that were developed by white people during that period, well, I'm sure there were some developments to all of the European languages during that period as well. And one of the things that the first European explorers found when they travelled to sub-Saharan Africa is that there was no form of written language in sub-Saharan Africa, and there was no form of system of numbers, and so therefore written language and numbers, certainly numbers that are above above number nine, don't actually, you know, aren't actually part of African culture. And for Africans to, it could be considered that for Africans to use written language and number systems that go above number nine, that is cultural appropriation, I would have thought. Perhaps something ought to be said about that as well.
Well, white supremacy, at least. I mean, going by this standard, if music notation is white supremacy and we can't have that, then, reading and writing, that's white supremacy as well. We'll have to ban that. I guess I should be pleased that they're no longer claiming that Beethoven was actually black. That was an idea that they had a couple of years back. Now they're just going to cancel Beethoven completely, along with Mozart, in the wake of BLM, of course.
Beethoven was disabled, wasn't he? Beethoven was deaf. He still managed to write music.
To
a very high standard.
Yeah, he might well be. But you would have thought that he would get woke brownie points for that, wouldn't you? They could say diversity.
That's what I was thinking. He definitely ought to get woke brownie points for that. Yes, that's remarkable that somebody could write music when they can't even hear it.
Surprisingly, proposals caused some upset among some faculty members who argued that it was unfair to accuse those teaching music from before 1900 of being concerned with just white. I guess calling them white supremacists. But I mean, the fact of the matter is that black people really weren't involved in classical music, and that is just a fact of history. That they've decided that they can't shoehorn black people in and pretend that these people were actually black, so they're just going to pretend that we don't actually have that history anymore. But it is shameful that they're going after Oswald Mosley's grandson just because they don't like what Oswald Mosley's beliefs were. And of course, Oswald Mosley's beliefs, they were a product of his time. You know, our beliefs today as nationalists are different to Oswald Mosley's. I mean, he was quite keen for the European Union, wasn't he? Make Europe a super nation was his idea, I think, a famous speech of his.
So if Max Mosley had donated the money in honour of his son, so that a chair in fascist political science was to be established, then that would actually give more credence to the complaints that are being made. But in fact, the money hasn't been donated for those purposes whatsoever. It's been donated to provide accommodation for students and to provide a chair for biophysics. And so it's just madness. These people say that it's political correctness gone mad, but political correctness is actually madness. It's the people who profess wokeness and political correctness, they just keep on taking things to the next extreme and the next extreme, and to the point now where there are aspects of the world today that are just plain and simply laughable. And you can imagine that if a race of alien beings came from outer space and were observing the Earth today, they would laugh their socks off at the mess that's currently being made of our civilization by people of liberals and the wokearati.
Well, I mean, so much of it is based on lies, isn't it? If something is politically correct, it means it's not correct. It has that descriptive term politically at the front of it, which means it's something different to correct. If it's not correct, it's not correct. So it means that everything is based on lies, and the more they push it, the more absurd it actually becomes. We've also had Marks and Spencers that have been diving into the fray as well with their diversity managers, Max. What's been going on there?
Well, it's been revealed today in the, I think it was on the Daily Mail website, that Marks and Spencers has started to give out badges to its members of staff with their name on it, obviously, which is something they've been doing for quite some time. But now these badges will also include that person's preferred pronouns. Of either the badge will either say John, and then underneath John it will say he, him, his, if John wants to be regarded as male, or if it's John, and it will have she, her, hers underneath it if John wants to be regarded as female, or it can be John with they, them, there written underneath it if John wants to be considered as being ambiguous and not binary, as they say. And so it's just utterly ridiculous that the people that work for Marks & Spencer are supposed to go to work in the shop in order to facilitate the sale of Marks & Spencer's goods to the general public. You know, what their preferred pronoun is completely irrelevant. Their job is to facilitate the sale of goods and services. You know, they're there to accept somebody's money and to give them and to sort of wrap the thing that the person wants to buy or put it into a bag and give it back to them and just pass daily pleasantries, not to broadcast to the people who purchase in the shop what their preferred pronoun is, or, you know, in reality, what their sexual identity happens to be. And
that's what it boils down to, isn't it? I mean, it's the sexual identity thing. And it also coincides with World Pronouns Day, UN World Pronouns Day. Whenever I see these ridiculous days, it just makes me think, you know, we used to honour the saints' days. Every day of the year or every week or so, there would be a particular day that was in honour of a particular saint, and it would be a saint that was associated with some particular virtue or resisting temptation. And instead of that now, we have these secular days, which are just about things like World Pronouns Day or Announce Your Gender Day or some other ridiculous thing. It just makes a mockery of Western civilization. And of course, last week we got one final news story. Last week we had COP26.
Go on. We move on. A good point to make here with regard to this is that if somebody is working for Marks & Spencer and they appear to be male, but they've got she, her, hers written under their name, what they're actually doing is that they are broadcasting to the customers of Marks & Spencer that they are transsexual, but they're doing that voluntarily. Now, if we transport ourselves mentally back to the middle of the 20th century, or perhaps the 30s and the 40s in Germany, for example, great outrage was felt on the parts of human rights campaigners that homosexuals that were sent to the concentration camps had to wear a tunic that had a pink triangle on it, signifying that they were homosexual, so that everybody they encountered would know that they're homosexual. And yet what these woke people are doing that work for Marks & Spencer is they are doing to themselves the very thing that they condemned in the Nazis during the last century. They're wearing a badge that labels them as a particular as having a particular sexual proclivity. And as I said earlier on, that's just madness. This whole thing is just, you know, all these things are just examples of a madness that seems to have engulfed certain people in the world today.
Well, so much of it is like that, isn't it? You know, it's like when Black Lives Matter are saying we want black judges, we want black police, we want black teachers. And we're like, well, yeah, we want the same. You know, we want segregation. We think you should have just live in your own black community and there would be no more racism there. So they're effectively calling for the same things that they had in America in the 40s and the 50s that we were told were so terrible, and Jim Crow laws, and black people had their own water fountains to drink out of, and they had their own schools, and how awful that was that black people had to live among other black people. And now they're calling for the same thing. And we were told it's so awful that, as you pointed out there, Max, that homosexuals had to wear a badge identifying themselves as homosexual. And now the M&S workers are going to do that. And just one other further thing that they're doing with these badges and these pronouns. At the Windows conference the other day, they took it one step further and they announced what hairstyles they had and what clothes they had. And when they were asked about this, and I thought, well, maybe they're doing that so that rather than people saying, oh, the Asian guy or the black guy, they would say, oh, the guy in the red T-shirt or the guy with the funny hairstyle. But they said, no, actually, that's for the visually impaired. So expect to see that coming up in the future as well. People will announce what their pronouns are, and then after that, they'll tell you what T-shirt they're wearing or what hairstyle they actually have. It is most bizarre. But yeah, we've got one final news story here, and that is COP26, I believe it's called, the Environmental Awareness Conference, with all the globalist hypocrites on the inside and Greta Thunberg and all the naive school children on the outside. What are your thoughts on that, Max?
Well, it's the COP26 has dominated the news for the last 2 weeks, and it's all, you know, as we all know, to do with global warming. And I think that it's fairly evident that there is global warming taking place. You know, over the last 50 years or so, the Earth has become a marginally warmer place than it was previous to that. But whether humans are primarily the cause of that warming or not is something which, in my view, hasn't yet been proven. And I was looking at an article in a science paper just the other day, and it was mentioning there that the scientists concerned had been able to obtain ice cores from the continent of Antarctica, and they'd bored down into the ice. And of course, the ice is so compacted over so many years that if you bore down deep enough, you can find ice that is as old as 800,000 years old. And from this ice, you can determine how warm or cold the world was at the time when that ice formed, because there are oxygen isotopes. I think it's isotope 16 and isotope 18. The combination of those isotopes that's found in the water or the ice when you bore down that far will tell you whether the planet was warmer then or colder then than it is today. And what these 800,000 year old ice cores tell us is that there have been at least four interglacial periods during the last 800,000 years where our planet has been for an extended period of time between 3 and 5 degrees centigrade hotter than it is today. And the last of those episodes was the period between about 115,000 years ago and 135,000 years ago. And it just struck me that the period 115 to 135,000 years ago was the period where the first major migration out of Africa was supposed to have taken place, if you believe the out of Africa theory. And it could well be that that this discovery of this particularly hot period does actually factor in human evolution, in that if Africa did become significantly hotter than it is today, then that would have caused desiccation of the land, that would have caused the forests to shrink, and that could well have driven quite a substantial part of the African population out of Africa at the time. And so that tends to sort of fit in with other theories that relate to other aspects of science. And but if you look back over the entire 800,000 year period, humans didn't exist throughout most of that period. You know, if you go back 600,000 years ago, there were no humans on the planet. And so there weren't any humans lighting fires or chopping trees down and burning the wood. There weren't any humans that were mining and digging up coal or anything of that sort. And yet there still have been fluctuations in the temperature of the planet that during the extremely warmest periods, the temperatures were as much as 5 degrees centigrade hotter than it is today. And during the coldest periods, it's been as much as 9 degrees centigrade lower than it is today during the heights of the ice age. And in fact, during most of the period since the last ice age, over the last 100,000 years or so, our planet has been much, much colder than it is today. And you've only got to go back something like about 20 or 30,000 years to a point where the planet was on average 9 degrees centigrade colder than it is today. And it's only during the last 5,000 years that the climate has remained roughly similar to what it is today, where it's been sort of either +1 degree or minus as much as -2 degrees centigrade different from the temperature that exists today. And so whilst it is true that over the last 50 years the Earth has become warmer, if we think about the the long-term view, the 800,000 years, the Earth isn't becoming warmer. The Earth is changing. It's going through periods where it is warmer than it is today, and it's gone through periods where it is has been much colder than it is today. And it's these changes in climate that actually are the drivers of evolution. You know, they would appear to have driven human ancestors out of Africa, so that they then had to exist and try to adapt to live in what then became much colder climates. Subsequently, in Europe, which then caused people to invent clothing and to develop housing that was warm, etc. And so, climate change isn't something that we should shrink back from and say, oh, how terrible things are and how we're destroying the planet. We're not destroying the planet. The planet is just changing. You know, the global warming that's taking place at the moment isn't destroying our weather system. It's not destroying our planet. It's just changing the planet. It's just moving the hot parts of the planet around, making some of the hot parts of the planet larger than they have been in the past, and making some of the cold parts of the planet smaller than they have been in the past. But these things I wouldn't quite say that they're cyclical, but these sort of changes have been taking place as far back as there is any kind of evidence to determine what climates have been. And you know, the very fact that most of Britain, in fact, most of the Earth's crust that forms the land that upon which people live, is comprised of rocks, where those rocks were formed at the bottom of the sea. And so, you know, even the very land that we stand on now was once the bottom of the sea. And it is climate change and the tectonic movements and all these kind of things that have changed the climate, changed the positions of the features of the Earth. And that's not anything that humans are going to be able to change. You know, that's going to carry on happening no matter what we do. Now, it's possible that some of the global warming that's taking place at the moment is actually being caused by humans. And if we change what we do, then we could affect it slightly. But I doubt that we're going to be able to exercise any significant control over the climate of the planet. It's, you know, trying to control the planet is a bit like King Canute sitting in his chair on the beach trying to command the sea to go back. You know, it's the sea is something which is much, much larger than King Canute was and has no connection to him and didn't have to obey his commands. And the climate is much, much larger than we are and doesn't have to obey our commands or our wishes. And we just got to bear in mind that the climate of this planet is going to change, and we can plan to adapt to that change. But when the measures that are being introduced, where there is this blind assumption that that climate change has all been caused by humans, and that we are evil people because we're destroying our planet, and all these various, as I say, measures are going to be introduced. What we've got to bear in mind is that what's going to happen, and the children who are currently campaigning for all these things to be done are going to have to face massively higher fuel bills, because fuel is going to become far more expensive in the future than it is now if the changes that are being muted are actually brought in. And there will be power shortages, because natural sources of power, wind and the tides, etc., can't be relied upon. And sometimes the sea is still, and sometimes the air is still, and there is no power being produced. So there has to be other forms of power that that will form part of the supply the national grid and the national grids of all the other countries across the world. We're also likely to be priced out of home heating and air conditioning, because these heat pumps that are being proposed are incredibly expensive, and so most people that are alive today that are still going to be alive in perhaps 20 years time are going to face the cost of having to splash out £18,000 to buy a heat pump, which is then going to heat their house to a far less efficient degrees than the current gas-powered central heating will do. If the planet does become warm and we want air conditioning, well, I'm sorry, we're probably going to have to just sweat, because air conditioning is then going to become more pricey, because it's going to involve burning electricity, etc., in order to provide that air conditioning. As far as cars are concerned, we're going to be priced out of car ownership because you've only got to look at the electric cars that are on the market today. They are something like double the cost of an internal combustion engine powered car. And you have to ask why that is, because if you look at small remote controlled cars, those small remote controlled cars, they all have electric motors in them. And the reason why the small remote control cars that are toys have got electric motors in them is because it's much cheaper to produce an electric motor than it is to produce an internal combustion engine. So if it's much, much cheaper to produce an electric engine to power a remote control car, why is it much, much more expensive to produce a larger scale thing to power a real car? And what I can see happening here is that the car manufacturers, who are suddenly being forced to scrap all of their production lines, etc., in order to re-equip them and retool them so that they can produce electric cars, are profiteering out profiteering from the idealism and the stupidity of people who think they're saving the planet. And they're just putting the price of cars up, saying, oh, you know, we've got to produce these new cars, so we have to charge a lot more for them. When in reality, they don't have to charge a lot more for them, because the engines that they're going to be putting in those cars in future cost only a fraction of what the of what internal combustion engines cost to produce. And people that the people of the younger generation today in future are going to have to will probably be priced out of air travel. And so it's going to be very, very difficult to produce electric aeroplanes. It's going to be very difficult to provide to produce nuclear powered aeroplanes. So, you know, what is going to power these aeroplanes when we try to make fleets of aircraft to provide air travel, and we try to produce it in a way which is carbon neutral? It's going to be what's going to happen is that air travel is going to become something which is very, very expensive, and that only the richest people are going to be able to do. And so we need to start thinking about climate change in an entirely different way. Stop regarding it as something that's can be controlled by humans. Yes, we can do things to help us to adapt to the changes that we've got no control over. But penalizing ourselves by restricting our options and insisting that we pay for things that are massively more expensive than the traditional things that have provided for us in the past is the way of stupidity. And as I say, we need to think again.
Yeah, it's just natural process, isn't it? The way that the Earth warms up and the way that it cools down, and electric cars, they've still got to produce the electricity for it. It's madness that they're doing away with the internal combustion engine, which produces electricity itself. I did see a JCB digger that had been created to run on hydrogen, and they said that the combustion engine is very, very similar to petrol and diesel engines, so engineers wouldn't have to retrain to learn how to work on hydrogen fuel. And it's just won an award with this JCB digger. And they're saying, well, this is what we should be using. And the only waste that it produces is steam. So perhaps that would be a better idea. But they've sunk everything into this idea of electric cars, which, as you say, Max, is going to price young people without so much money out of being able to drive. All those youngsters that are protesting outside of the Glasgow Centre, I mean, they're basically protesting for a worse life for themselves than their parents had. They're just being used by very, very cynically used, I think, by their teachers and by the state to campaign for policies that the government want to bring in themselves anyway, so that they can have their new world order and they can have just this one supranational government over everybody else. That's the point of it. I really don't think they're that concerned about the planet. They're just concerned about control.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. I often tell the story of when I was a student, and I was invited to go on a residential weekend course that was being organised by an organisation called Lions, which stood for Loyalty in Our Nation's Service. And I don't know whether all Lions organisations are like this all over the country, but this particular organisation arranged this weekend where we were being indoctrinated in that we should have no borders, that we should allow immigration across the borders, that wealthy people in the West constituted only 20% of the world's population, but we consumed 80% of the world's wealth, whereas the majority of people who lived in the third world countries that constituted 80% of the world's population only consumed 20% of the world's wealth, and that therefore the only fair thing to do would be to spread the wealth of the world evenly across the world. And I confronted these people on the basis that what they were actually proposing was communism. And after some quite sort of long and heated arguments, to almost to a man, the people who had been organizing this conference admitted that they actually were card-carrying members of the Communist Party at the time. And the point is that what is regarded as political correctness, what is regarded as globalism, is actually an authoritarian system of government akin to communism, which is being put in place. It's the new world order that's being put in place all over the world. And one of the main principles of that new world order is that they spread the wealth of the super rich, because the super rich will form the planners and the controllers. But as far as the majority of people are concerned, they're going to spread the wealth of people in the West across the third world. And all this focus on climate change is all part of that, because part of all these climate change measures that have been taken is that we donate billions of pounds to the countries of the third world so that they can adapt their country so that it can be more carbon neutral, because they can't do it themselves. And what we're doing is we're making ourselves poorer and the third world richer. And this is, you know, when I was on this course as a student, one of the things I confronted the people about is that if you try to spread the, you know, if what they say is true about 20% of the world's population having 80% of the world's wealth, etc., then to equalize the wealth per capita all across the world would involve a fourfold reduction in the living standards of people in the West and a fourfold increase in the living standards of people living in the third world. And this is what we can see being brought about as a result of these kind of measures, like these climate change conferences, etc., and the various treaties that they that governments are being pushed into and bullied into in some instances. It's the transfer of wealth from the Western world to the third world and our impoverishment for the benefit of the third world.
What they're ignoring there is that the fact that 100% of the wealth is actually generated by just 10% of the world, isn't it? I mean, it's white people that came up with 99% of all the inventions in the world. So they'll say, well, 20% of the world is using 80% of the wealth, but it's that 20% that generated that wealth. So they should be the recipients of it. Well, shall we get into our Greatest Britons for today then, Max? We finished with that, do you think?
Yes, that sounds like a good idea.
Let's get into our Greatest Briton for the week. Once again, it is Captain Robert Falcon Scott of the Antarctic, and we will begin with a recap of the last episode where we heard how Scott and his team became the first to cross into the blank space on the map, but they lost all their dogs in the process due to losing the dog food and taking rotten fish with them instead. Rather than waste a man sending someone to the same spot to try and go further, Scott decided it would be better to concentrate on the other parts of the mission, which induced resentment in Armitage, who thought this was down to him being a merchant navy man, while Scott was from the Royal Navy. Ernest Shackleton got scurvy, and rather than risk him catching it again, it was decided that he should go back with the supply ship when she arrived, marking a full year spent in the Antarctic. The Discovery was stuck tight in the ice, and rather than abandon her, the team decided to stay for another year, and we left Scott and his men at the summit of Victoria Land, which they discovered was just an endless plateau, nearly 900 feet above sea level. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Well, just that for those people that were there, it must have, and I suppose for people that have taken part in similar expeditions since, you know, going to Antarctica, Antarctica is almost like going to a different world. It's a world where the landscape is entirely different, where the environment is entirely different. And that's quite a, it's quite an awesome prospect to behold, going to a place like that. And, knowing that you've got to venture into that strange environment further than anybody else has ever ventured before.
Yeah, the first people to get there, rather like being at the bottom of the ocean or being on the surface of the moon. Well, continuing with our narrative here, it was now a familiar story. Hunger, exhaustion, deep sastrugi, the snowdrifts in the ice, fog, snowdrifts, frostbite and snow blindness. Food ran short and the oil was nearly gone. On December the 14th, Scott faced the fact that they were lost. They had reached the edge of the plateau and were beginning to descend when Lashley slipped and started to slide on his back down the slope. In the process, he took the legs out from under the others and down they went, sledge and all. And when they came to a halt, they were stunned to find themselves at the head of the glacier, in familiar territory, only 5 or 6 miles from their depot, and miraculously, there were no broken bones. In Lashley's words, all of a sudden, the captain and Evans disappeared down a crevasse and carried away one of the sledge runners, leaving me on top. It was now my duty to try and get them up again. Scott and Evans were left dangling with blue walls of ice on either side and nothingness below. Remarkably, Scott was able to swing his feet around and grip the wall with his crampons. Using the last of his strength, Scott was able to climb out to safety while Lashley pulled Evans up, whose only comment was, "Well, I'm blowed." That night, quite a shock there. That night, they reached the depot, and 8 days later, on Christmas Eve, they reached the ship. In 59 days, they had hauled their sledge 725 miles. So don't forget, they've lost the dogs now. They're having to pull the sledges themselves. I mean, that must have been quite a rush of adrenaline there. You imagine you're just left there dangling over the side, and you've got to swing yourself into that wall of ice and get your crampons in and then try to pull yourself back up. You know, you've got to use all your strength, and they're in what, you know, freezing temperatures here, minus 40, minus 50. Very, very lucky to not have any broken bones after that. Well, only 4 men were at the ship to greet them when they arrived, as the others were out on the ice 10 miles away, soaring and blasting at it in the hope of breaking it up to a point where the Discovery could finally be freed. Scott was pleased that all the sledging trips had returned safely, and on the Western Mountains, Ferrar had discovered a fossil leaf, and Wilson was pleased with the results of his penguin expedition. They went looking for penguin eggs. By the end of December, Scott would write, 20 miles of ice hangs heavy on me, as he knew he had to start preparations for a third winter at Hut Point. On January the 5th, 1904, a ship came into view. It was the Morning, and a few minutes later, Wilson exclaimed, "Why, there's another." Wilson wrote, "We were dumbfounded." Wilson and Scott set off for the two ships and were subsequently greeted at the edge of the ice by 4 men speaking such perfect Dundee that we could hardly understand a word that they said. They were from the second ship, the Terra Nova. Soon Wilson and Scott were aboard the Morning receiving their mail and questioning their old friend William Colbeck as to why 2 relief ships were at anchor in McMurdo Sound. When the Morning returned from the Antarctic in 1903, Markham was delighted with the news of Scott's expedition, but he realised that clearly a second relief expedition would be necessary. Unfortunately, there was little money left, so together with Sir William Huggins, Markham appealed to the government for a grant of £12,000. Markham knew all along that a second relief expedition would be necessary, but this was a fact he had concealed from the government when the original plans were laid. The government felt misled and promptly took the matter out of the hands of the societies. If left up to Markham and his group, the government felt they would find an excuse to leave them on the ice for yet another year. The government would take no chances, as the goal would be to get the men home safe and sound, even if it meant abandoning the Discovery. On June the 20th, 1903, the government agreed to pay for the relief expedition, provided the mourning was handed over absolutely and at once, free of charge, to the Admiralty. Reluctantly, both societies agreed, and the mourning now had new owners. Sir William Wharton, the hydrographer, was appointed by the Admiralty as chairman to the newly formed Antarctic Relief Committee. So the government have had to set up an Antarctic Relief Committee, sort of unbeknownst to Scott and the rest of them, who did not want to leave their ship and were thinking, well, we'll have just have to stay here until the ship is freed. But the government are saying, no, we're not having that. You're going to have to come home, lads. We can't leave you out there all this time. Now, the government took an odd position. Wharton wrote, "It cannot be considered as certain that the mourning could get through single-handed, and a second vessel, if a suitable one could be found, would be a great additional safeguard." This decision by the Admiralty came on June 22, 1903, which gave them little more than 4 months to locate, refit, and get her to Lyttelton by mid-November. Wharton investigated resources all over Europe in an attempt to find a worthy whaling vessel that could accomplish the goal, and it was from St. John's, Newfoundland, that the suggestion came to purchase the Terra Nova. She was considerably larger than the Morning, at 744 tons and 187 feet in length, and she came at a hefty price. She was purchased on July the 6th for £20,000, some 17,200 more than Markham had paid for the Morning, and well above her appraised value. Try as they might, by the time she was ready to sail, it was simply too late in the season for the Terra Nova to reach New Zealand on her own, and still leave enough time to make McMurdo Sound. So Wharton instructed her to be towed by naval vessels as far as the Persian Gulf, from where she would continue on under her own sail and steam. HMS Minerva towed her from Portsmouth to Gibraltar, HMS Vindictive took her on to Aden, and from there HMS Fox towed her to an area 120 miles off the east coast of Socotra, where she was left on her own for the final leg. The Terra Nova abandoned plans to meet the Morning in Lyttelton, as it was closer to sail directly to Hobart, Tasmania, and meet up with her there. The two ships met in Hobart on October 31st, and together they departed for McMurdo Sound. And it's interesting they still had these great big whaling ships back then. I should imagine that the actual resources from the whale were really useful. All that blubber, all that oil for lamps. I mean, we forget that whales themselves were a massive resource to us in the past, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. But the story as you're telling it sort of shows really the immense logistical challenge that getting a ship down to the Antarctic presented, even though this is a rescue mission, it still requires immense resources. It still requires a tremendous amount of planning, the rescue mission is can be considered just as demanding and just as challenging as the actual expedition itself in some ways.
And I think the men themselves were quite embarrassed by this as well. Scott and his fellow officers were not only dismayed but insulted by the arrival of the Terra Nova along with the Morning. They had no idea of the problems encountered by Markham in England, but one thing they knew for certain, one ship was all that was needed, and to send two implied that they were in deep trouble and unable to handle things on their own. Scott wrote, "It was not a little trying to be offered relief to an extent which seemed to suggest that we have been reduced to the direst need. No healthy man likes to be thought of as an invalid." Scott was very concerned that his career would be jeopardised. After all, if found an incompetent commander by his superiors, he might as well forget any promotion upon their return. Ironically, the government seemed concerned that the expedition might be having too good a time. To them, it made no sense to have their officers and men remain indefinitely in the Antarctic on full pay, all the while feasting on seals and provisions sent at great expense in an annual relief ship. In July 1903, the government could not consent to the officers and men of the Royal Navy being employed in any further expedition in the ice, even if sufficient private funds were raised for such a purpose, and that Commander Scott will receive directions to this effect. These directions were given to Colbeck, commander of the Terra Nova. To make matters even worse, instructions were given to Colbeck to have the Discovery abandoned if she could not be freed from the ice. Scott was furious. In normal conditions, a sailor would go through much rather than abandon his ship, but the ties which bound us to the Discovery were far beyond the ordinary, Scott wrote. She was dearly loved by her crew. She had been their home for 2.5 years. She was considered the finest ship ever built for such a task, and to abandon her would be like a broken marriage. It may not have been their fault, but the men would have returned as castaways, with the sense of failure dominating the results of our labours. 20 miles of ice separated the ship from open water in mid-January. Captain Mackey of the Terra Nova felt the departure date should not extend beyond February 25, 1904, and Colbeck agreed. Blasting and soaring proved useless, so nothing was left but to pray for southeasterly gales. Aboard the Discovery, Scott read the Admiralty's instructions to his crew, and there was a strong, stony silence. I had not heard a laugh in the ship since I returned. And this is really quite serious, isn't it? Because, I mean, they're seeing this as really embarrassing if they have to leave the ship there. And these are the sort of things that you don't think about when you first hear about this. The crew began the difficult task of transferring all the scientific collections and equipment to the Morning and the Terra Nova. For the next 5 weeks, the ice slowly began to break up. An all-out attack on the ice was put into gear. Explosives, saws, and everything imaginable was used in an attempt to free the ship. On January 27th, Scott wrote, I much fear, things are going badly for us. Royds wrote, it is perfectly sickening. Why doesn't it break up? What the devil is holding it? The prospects are as cheerless as they could be, and I could simply scream at our absolute helplessness. The thermometer fell to minus 14 degrees Fahrenheit. By February 3rd, Royds wrote, things look hopeless. Everything is at a standstill. On February 12th, Royds wrote, as I write, the Terra Nova is now only 2 miles away and the ice continues to break away. The ice was simply rushing out in huge lumps and flows, every blast sending more out and cracking well behind. So suddenly the tide has turned here for them. Now they worked harder than ever to free the ship as destiny was in the balance. St. Valentine's Day saw the break they needed as Scott and others raced up to Hut Point and noted that the ice was breaking up right across the strait and with a rapidity which we had not thought possible. I have never witnessed a more impressive sight. The sun was low behind us, the surface of the ice sheet in front was intensely white, and in contrast the distant sea and its forking leads looked almost black. The wind had fallen to a calm, and not a sound disturbed the stillness about us. Yet in the midst of this peaceful scene was an awful unseen urgency rending that great ice sheet as though it had been naught but the thinnest paper. Now without a word, without an effort on our part, it was all melting now, and we knew that in an hour or two not a vestige of it would be left, and that the open sea would be lapping on the black rocks of Hut Point. I mean, this makes it really clear that the climate fluctuates, doesn't it? They spent 2 years there, frozen, totally frozen in the ice, and on the third year it melts, and they're finally going to be able to get out. And no doubt in the fourth year it would have all frozen up again. The relief ships butted their way side by side to the Discovery. The men cheered as the Terra Nova broke through the last sheet of ice at 10:30 p.m. and freed the Discovery. A few days were hurriedly spent preparing the ships for departure, and in memory to George Vince, a final emotional ceremony was held on the ice, and a wooden cross was erected to mark his grave. And remember, that's the one man of the crew that ended up dying right at the start of the expedition.
Yeah.
Despite a difficult departure to open water, the three ships finally were underway, leaving McMurdo Sound on February 19th, 1904. Scott decided to take the Discovery around Cape Adare and explore to the west along the northern coast of Victoria Land. The Morning was to head straight for the Auckland Islands, where the three ships would rendezvous and sail together to Lyttelton. After 2 years in the ice, the Discovery was far from seaworthy. Water poured into the holds, the pumps wouldn't work, gales came up, and subsequently everyone got seasick since they'd been landlocked for so long. The rudder was in such poor shape, The rudder was in such poor shape that it was ready to fall off. They had a spare, but it was only half as big. I mean, how are they going to get that on? They're going to have to go over the side to change it?
And hold their breath and go under there.
Crazy. The further west they went, the thicker the ice became. Becoming short of coal, the ship turned north to find open water so they could use the sails. By this time, she had lost touch with the Terra Nova. And of course, they didn't have wireless radios at this time either. She was pushed so far north that she missed land altogether and instead rediscovered the Bellini Islands. On March the 14th, they reached the Auckland Islands with only 10 tons of coal left aboard. Neither of the other ships were there. So while they waited, some of the crew cleaned and painted the ship, while others went ashore and shot anything that looked edible, including wild cattle and pigs. The New Zealand government also maintained a depot of emergency supplies for the use of shipwrecked sailors, called by the sealers Sarah's Bosom. The other vessels, do you want to add anything there, Max? Any thoughts on that?
No, it's just really called by the sailor Sarah's Bosom.
Yeah, it's a good name, isn't it? Welcoming name for them to come across. The other vessels showed up a few days later, and after 3 days sailing, on Good Friday, April 1st, 1904, they reached Lyttelton Harbour. There was a wonderful welcoming party, and guests and reporters swarmed the ships. Unfortunately, a remark made by Scott in a crowd was overheard by a reporter who took the comment totally out of context and falsely reported the incident. What a surprise. The men of the Discovery were in total agreement concerning the absurdity of sending the Terra Nova to rescue them. The story published by a Reuters reporter made headlines in England. Commander Scott emphatically protests against the dispatch by the Admiralty of the Terra Nova, which he declares to have been a wasteful expense of money. He says that had the proper position of the Discovery been made known, it would have been obvious that she was perfectly safe, and no assistance beyond that which the morning could render was requisite. Scott felt his goose was cooked when it came to a promotion. Even Royds commented, although it was the truth, he never said it. Back home, matters weren't much better. Together with his brother-in-law, Scott was still supporting his mother. His two sisters were having a difficult time in the dressmaking industry. As his mother wrote, it is really a bad season and no money going. Scott felt that if he was not promoted, a certain life of poverty would return. He wrote to his mother from New Zealand, "If they wait till we get home, then two or three persons will inevitably leap over my head. The question is whether they will pass me over in June. It is such a close thing that it must make a great deal of difference." So we sort of forget about the personal issues that were going on while they were away. Meanwhile, the ship was in need of repairs, and yet money was so tight that Scott only paid the regular crew members while the officers were left to fend for themselves. Everybody wrote home from Lyttelton. Royds and Wilson wrote to Scott's mother, Hannah, telling her how proud they were of her son's efforts. Wilson wrote, "Without a doubt, he has been the making of the expedition, and not one of us will but feel more and more grateful to him for the way he has acted throughout. Notwithstanding that it is a difficult thing, at least I imagine it is, for the captain to make intimate friends with anyone, I feel as though we were real friends, and I need hardly say I am proud of it." The Discovery was placed in dry dock for 2 months to complete repairs. Meanwhile, Scott was wined and dined by the dignitaries all over the island. He wrote to his mother, "We have had a very good time here, but it is high time we were off, as all our young men are getting engaged. Skelton is actually caught. I believe the young lady is very nice." The young lady was Sybil. Others were caught as well, Teddy Evans of the Morning and Ferrar among the others, Blissett and Weller among the men. Incredibly, Royds and Scott were actually taken to court and fined £5 for shooting cattle on Enderby Island in the Auckland Islands while waiting for the other ships to rendezvous. Although running wild, they had no idea that the cattle were private property. It's and again, you know, we don't sort of think about these things, but the Discovery itself is going to have to be fixed up and ready to go. And I'm quite touched by the fact that his crew members wrote to his mother.
Yeah,
you know, they wanted his family to know what such a good man he was.
Yeah, that's very touching, that is, isn't it?
Yeah,
and it's the sort of loyalty that comes as that's earned loyalty rather than the sort of sycophantic loyalty that people that are promoted above their own ability very often insist upon from the people that work under them.
Yeah, it's just a really good thing to think of doing, isn't it? As for the scientists' work, the collections went to the British Museum of Natural History and their statistical material to the Royal Society. Upon arrival in England, all the scientists went their separate ways. Wilson worked on his huge collection at the Natural History Museum, and he never went back to medical practice. The servicemen had no problems with future employment. They simply slipped back into their regular jobs without any loss of seniority. Royds figured it would take 10 years before a promotion, and he was quite accurate as he did not reach the rank of captain until 1914. Skelton made a brilliant career for himself in the Royal Navy, but it was Scott who pondered his fate as the Discovery sailed from Lyttelton on June 8, 1904. On September 10th, over 3 years after leaving, the Discovery reached Spithead. Sir Clements Markham and his wife were aboard the ship when she steamed into Portsmouth Harbour, where all the men of war and a line of boats sent from Whale Island gave hearty cheers. It was here that Scott learned of his appointment as post-captain, which was to take effect the following day. In his welcoming speech at the East India docks on September 16th, Markham declared, "Never has any polar expedition returned with so great a harvest of scientific results. Truly, this had been the most revealing of all Antarctic exploration, as meticulous records were kept on the scientific work." But Scott could not accept full credit, as he proclaimed that an Antarctic expedition is not a one-man show, not a two-man show, nor a ten-man show. It means the cooperation of all. There has been nothing but a common desire to work for the common good. Scott now moved his mother and two sisters to a house they found at 56 Oakley Street off the Chelsea Embankment, and this was to be Scott's home for 4 years, and it still stands today, marked by a blue commemorative plaque. Initially, Scott received royal thanks, but his only honour was the appointment to Commander of the Victorian Order, a step up from the membership which he already had. Even the press hounded the government, as they felt he should have at least received an Order of the Bath, if not a knighthood.
Yeah, when you consider knighthoods and that are dished out nowadays, I think what Scott did was far more than the people that are ennobled nowadays tend to do.
Far more than a donation to the Tories, isn't it? Which is
that's right.
Yeah, you get made into one of the Lords. An exhibition at the Bruton Galleries opened on November 4th, 1904, which drew an estimated 10,000 visitors. Inside were a collection of Wilson's drawings, Skelton's photographs, a model of the Discovery, sledging equipment, and rations. On November 7th, Scott gave his first big lecture to 7,000 invited members and guests of the two societies at Albert Hall. Now the praise was raining down upon Scott. He was awarded the Patron's Gold Medal of the Royal Geographical Society, was made a member of the French Legion of Honour and the Russian Geographical Society, and received medals from the Geographical Societies of Philadelphia, Denmark, and Sweden. What pleased him most was an honorary degree of Doctor of Science from Cambridge University. When he left London, he headed for Edinburgh for more lectures and the Royal Geographical Society's Livingstone Medal. Shackleton had arranged this, and now the two were on excellent terms. Scott wrote to his mother, "Everyone is very pleased with Shackleton. He is showing great energy and business capacity." Scott travelled with Shackleton to Glasgow and Dundee for more speaking engagements. Meanwhile, Markham pleaded with the government to retain the Discovery for future polar work, but his remarks fell upon deaf ears. She was sold to the highest bidder, the Hudson's Bay Company, for £10,000, about one quarter of her original cost. I'd like to see the Discovery. I don't know if it's still around, or maybe it's wasting away somewhere. Scott continued to travel around the country giving lectures and making preparations to publish a book about the expedition. He wrote, "Of all things, I dread having to write a narrative and am wholly doubtful of my capacity in any event. If I have to do it, it will take me a long time. I have not the pen of a ready writer. By the start of 1905, the book was nearly completed. On October 12th, in an edition of 3,000 copies, The Voyage of the Discovery was published. An incredible piece of work. The two-volume edition was profusely illustrated with Wilson's drawings and Skelton's photographs. Scott needlessly worried about his abilities for writing, as nearly all the critics praised it. The Times Literary Supplement called it a masterly work. His former crew members each received a free copy and they all loved it. Scott insisted on sending Wilson a cheque for £100 as a fee for reproducing his drawings. Wilson refused, but Scott made him take it anyway. Today, a single drawing can fetch $10,000 or more. The book sold reasonably well. The first edition sold out immediately, so 1,500 more copies were printed the following month. But then the sales fell dramatically when the book went out of print in 1919. Total sales amounted to 5,272 copies. And it says here, try to find one. Scott was a little concerned with Armitage's newly published book, 2 Years in the Antarctic, which also came out in the autumn of 1905, but he wrote nothing derogatory about his former leader. I'm amazed at that. The total sales, 5,000 copies. I mean, what that really says to me is that there really weren't that many people that actually read books back then.
Yeah, that could well be the case. I would have thought that worldwide there would have certainly been, or even nationwide, there certainly should have been more people that would have bought copies than that. But if it was partway through the First World War, then lots of men who perhaps would have been of an adventurous spirit and who volunteered to go off and fight would have been preoccupied with fighting. In 1919, it's just after the First World War, isn't it?
And it came out in 1905. Came out in 1905.
Oh, 1905, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, so in 1919, perhaps, the total sales were just 5,000 copies. That was all. Total sales out of all of them.
Yeah, well, so between 1905 and 1919, what I would say does hold, really, that would have been the period that the First World War would have been fought in, albeit it started in 1914. But the point is that, perhaps the sort of people who would have liked to have read that book would have been preoccupied with the war for some of that period of time, and perhaps preoccupied with other things. I don't know. It just seems strange, doesn't it?
Well, it's nice to see that he's finally getting all these awards as well, and he's made into an honorary scientist, and that he credits it all to his men.
Yeah, when you said about how he had delivered a lecture to 7,500 people from the Royal Society, etc., that my mind immediately flicked to, what sort of location could you assemble 7,500 people? And obviously the Albert Hall, and I've been to the Albert Hall on quite a few occasions and seen various to conferences that have been held there, or to concerts that have been held there, and it is a fantastic building, and you can just imagine, can't you, being on the stage in the Albert Hall as Scott delivering a lecture where you're telling all these people about the all the entertaining things, really, you've been saying to me over the last few weeks, the stuff that made us laugh. I don't know whether Scott would have gone into that sort of detail about them, all the sort of the mechanics of taking their sweaty boots off and stuff, and putting them somewhere so they didn't freeze overnight and all that sort of stuff. You can just imagine it. People would have been gripped, wouldn't they, listening to that sort of thing?
Yeah, it would have been really quite nerve-wracking as well, I should imagine, speaking in front of 7,000 people. I mean, it's quite an incredible story. I mean, he certainly well deserves to be up there in our greatest Britons. And there's more to his life as well, which we'll probably get into in the next episode, but I think we shall leave that here for today. So thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
It's been good fun. Thank you.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope that you have a great week ahead of you.